Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The legal fight over Michigan's emergency manager law moves to the federal appeals court.
We've been arguing as consistently all along that the emergency manager law violates people's fundamental right to vote in a number of ways.
But first, 2 weeks of political conventions and a week into the general election campaign. How are voters in Michigan feeling about Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump? A new poll from the Detroit News and WDIV-TV gives us some insights. Chad Livengood of the Detroit News is here with us. Let's start with the poll findings in the presidential race and Clinton versus Trump. And we have heard Rust Belt states are critical for Donald Trump. What's his story right now in Michigan?
Right now, Donald Trump is trailing Hillary Clinton. Our new Detroit News WDIV poll, 41% to 32%. This 9-point gap comes right after on the heels of the Democratic National Convention. Hillary Clinton obviously tried to get as much of a boost out of that as possible. And Trump has, you know, had kind of a rocky 10 days after his national convention in Cleveland, in which he's been sort of embroiled in one controversy after another and continued sort of infighting with Republican leaders. But the big thing in this poll that really kind of comes out is that Trump is trailing Hillary Clinton by 21 points among women. And most surprisingly, he is trailing Hillary Clinton in West Michigan, Rock Rib Republican territory there. Hillary Clinton leads by 5 points in West Michigan, 6 points in Southwest Michigan. And you got to remember, these are also areas that Donald Trump didn't do so well in the Republican primary back in March. He lost to Ted Cruz in the 2nd and 3rd district around Grand Rapids. He also lost the 6th district down in Southwest Michigan. So he's got some areas and some issues with the Republican base where he's still not, you know, brought everybody home. That's usually the mission when you're at your national convention is to unify the party. Obviously, the spats with Republican Party establishment leaders are pretty well known, and they continue. And this is recently in the last couple of days, some of the party leaders, Ryan Primus, the National Committee Chair, former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, have been trying to sort of have an intervention with Trump, try to get him back on topic about the economy, Hillary Clinton's record.
Stop fighting with the cons, with the Gold Star family.
Yeah, exactly.
It's certainly the fact that we have seen Mike Pence campaigning in West Michigan, and we've got Donald Trump due to speak at the Detroit Economic Club on Monday. Pretty strong signs Michigan is a priority for their campaign.
Yeah, I mean, Pence was up in Walker at the Deltaplex a week ago. I mean, that's a week out from the national convention, and he was clearly trying to deliver a message that Donald Trump is one of them. He made an emphasis that Donald Trump will appoint justices to the Supreme Court who will seek to overturn Roe v. Wade. I mean, he was trying to tap into that social conservative electorate there, but also very libertarian electorate. And on that front, Gary Johnson, the libertarian candidate, polls at 7.5% in our poll here, and he is pulling people out of the Republican base. 30% of Republicans are going with someone other than Donald Trump. They're either undecided. Some are going to Hillary Clinton, not a lot. There's a significant crowd that are leaning towards Gary Johnson. I mean, they're just so turned off by Donald Trump. So that kind of speaks to this problem that Donald Trump has got to pull his own base into the tent if he expects to be competitive in Michigan this fall.
And what about Hillary Clinton? Where's her strongest base of support, either demographically or geographically?
Well, as you would expect, I mean, demographically, women is her best base, but also geographically within the urban centers and suburbia. She does pretty well in Oakland County. She doesn't do as well in Macomb County. Macomb County is Donald Trump's stronghold that kind of ties into his message that's aimed at the Michigan auto worker message on trade, an issue that he has basically cornered Hillary Clinton on. And he also does well in the UP and northern Michigan. But Hillary Clinton has some pretty strong numbers in southeast Michigan, which is, frankly, you know, where the votes are and where the battle usually is fought.
It is interesting that you know, a week into the general campaign, the general election campaign, and we are hearing Trump making noises about the election being rigged, and I can't believe that my poll numbers aren't higher.
Yeah, I mean, what Republican strategists are trying to sort of emphasize, and leaders as well, is that when you're off talking about, sort of fighting little spats with private individuals and sort of, you know, running a campaign that's been very social media and headline-driven, they're not necessarily going to have the attention of the voter. And so, interesting enough, he's coming to Detroit on Monday to deliver what's being billed as a major economic speech at the Detroit Economic Club. He's going to be essentially appearing before, you know, the titans of the auto industry, who he has been actively criticizing for moving jobs to Mexico over the last two decades. So that's going to be an interesting dynamic to watch there as Trump tries to essentially sell his message to a sort of a sometimes skeptical crowd, actually. One might even think that Hillary Clinton might get a better reception among auto executives.
And we can't let you go without touching on what the Detroit News WDIV poll has found about Governor Snyder, who was reminding everybody earlier this summer, quote, reports of my demise are well overblown.
You know, Governor Snyder is not going anywhere, even though there's a lot of people out there who would like to see him resign, you know, in response to the Flint water crisis. But his approval rating has dipped below 40% and said that it's sort of at the basin as low as it's been in his 5 years in office. And 54% of likely voters disapprove of the governor's job performance. And you know, as our pollster Richard Zuba noted, I mean, it's probably a good thing that he's term limited because it would be very hard for him to run for re-election at this point.
Chad Livengood, Detroit News Lansing Bureau. Appreciate it, Chad. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
We spend time and effort talking about homelessness, ways to reach out, ways to help. My next guest approaches this not as a policymaker, not as a researcher, but as one young person reaching out to homeless young people in her state. Lena Giratli recently graduated from the International Academy High School in Oakland County. Last summer, as she headed into her senior year, Lena launched a volunteer project called Help Bring Hope. Lena, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Why did you found this effort, Help Bring Hope?
Right. Well, I've had a passion to help homeless kids since I've been 8 years old. I remember when I was 8 years old and I was just a little kid, I'd look at homeless kids and then I'd look at myself and I didn't see much difference. And I remember being so profoundly confused as a young kid. And so I just felt such desire and activism to help out this cause.
So what are the goals of Help Bring Hope?
Well, our mission statement is to save every single homeless kid in this country and to get them off of the street. Is that ambitious? Yes. But do I think it's possible? Yes. And I don't think I'm being too idealistic because I feel like this nation has the resources and we have the care. It's just about if we can really bring that out, especially with this upcoming generation. Because part of what I try to do is try to lead my fellow youth members, mm-hmm. right, in this community. And just try to help feed into this generation of advocacy and change and caring about others.
So in doing this, in launching Help Bring Hope, give us an idea of the kind of activities and some specific things you've done.
Well, we started out with our summer fundraisers, and we would involve very artistic individuals who would make bracelets, toys, just all types of arts and crafts. And then we'd sell those. I remember a few of the boys, they started like a soccer fundraising game. So the players who played in this game would like pay an entry fee. We're just trying our best to not only raise money, but hold drives and deliver those items from those drives, 100% of them.
So who's doing this? How are you getting people on board the effort?
Well, any young person knows that the social media platform is a powerful platform. And if you utilize it well, you can reach out to a mass group of people. So especially among kids. So we have an Instagram. We have a Twitter. We post and we update frequently.
What have you done in terms of maybe money raised and where has it gone?
Well, in terms of the money raised, we don't directly give that money to shelters, but we take that money and we buy supplies. So far, we have delivered over 12,000 items to homeless youth shelters in Detroit and the greater Detroit area.
I'm interested because I know this. I can tell this is something you're very passionate about. Mm-hmm. I take it, you know, you're off to college, but you're going to be able to continue doing this.
Yes.
How do you bridge the class gap as you go forward in this work? Are you thinking of that in a sense of, you know, you're from the Bloomfield Hills area and the people you're trying to help? Well, they certainly aren't. How do you think about building trust?
Yes, that's something I was actually talking to my parents about that the other day. I'm very privileged. I'm very privileged. I have a loving support system. I have food on my table. and I have a shelter. And these kids don't. And sometimes when we have to go to shelters, we have to drive like miles upon miles to get there. And yeah, I do sometimes feel like I'm in this bubble. And to try to bridge that, I think it's less about here's a privileged college student and then here's a homeless kid. Here's a human to a human. When it comes down to it, like just that human connection is what matters most.
What do you hope to happen for Help Bring Hope?
Right. I think we want to involve as many student volunteers to activate this agent of change within them. We want not only to inspire kids to help homeless kids, but we want to inspire kids to follow their own passion, whether it's helping animals or providing education to kids all over the world, ending child labor. I mean, the list really does go on. We want to just spread positivity and change. And we think it's very much so possible.
How do people find you? How do they find you on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram?
Yes. Well, we have an Instagram. Our username is Michigan Homeless Youth. And we have a Twitter. It's helping_Detroit. And then from those, you can find our Facebook link. It's in our bio. So
Lena Giratli, founder of Help Bring Hope. Thank you so much for being with us, Lena. Good luck.
Thank you for having me. It's a privilege.
Up next, could a prehistoric fish help fight the war on Asian carp? And then in 10 minutes, you know Detroit as Motown or Motor City. What about Music City? You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's got scales so tough, Native Americans once used them as arrowheads. They can grow longer than a horse. And guess what? They love to munch on Asian carp. We're talking about the alligator gar. This ancient fish is found in the South, especially Texas and Louisiana. But they're being restocked in rivers and lakes as far north as Illinois, hoping they might control Asian carp and, in turn, protect the Great Lakes. Elise Ferrara is with us now. She's a professor of biological sciences and an alligator gar expert with Nicholls State University in Louisiana. Elise, just what is an alligator gar? Because, gosh, these things are huge.
Well, they're a very unique ancient fish, and you know, a lot of times people will use the term primitive to describe them, and I don't like that because sometimes it has negative connotations. To me, these fish got it right early and they stuck with it. So they've been around for about 180 million years, and they are able to withstand conditions that most fish cannot tolerate. I definitely don't want to push the stocking of alligator gar in Michigan because that's outside of the historic range.
Mm.
I definitely agree with the use of these fish to control carp and potentially other types of invasive fishes in the historic range of alligator gar. But as far as we know, they've not been found as far north as the Great Lakes. There is a smaller relative, the spotted gar, that is native to the Great Lakes, and then also long-nosed gar. But alligator gar themselves, you know, if they were stocked, I don't know if they'd be able to tolerate the cold winters, so that may be one way that we could actually stock them safely and they would die in the winter. But bringing a species outside of its native range is not something that I would like to endorse.
So we'll start with realizing that alligator gar like to snack on Asian carp?
Yes, yes they do. The gar, because of their size, are one of the few fishes, native fishes, that can eat a carp. And one of the things that's really interesting about the gars is they have a whole bunch of very kind of needle-like teeth. They're very pointy at the bottom, and they get a little bit broader at the base, so they're almost like cone-shaped. And they're a type of predator that has to swallow their prey whole. So they don't have teeth that are cutting surfaces, like what you would think of as in a shark. So if an alligator gar were to bite you, it's not going to rip off a chunk of your arm or a chunk of your leg. It's going to put a whole bunch of little needle marks in your arm and probably shake you around. But they don't tear off pieces of their prey. They must swallow it whole. And if you get bitten by an alligator gar, you're probably doing something wrong. You're probably doing something to that fish that you shouldn't be doing.
Because
they're not going to go after humans.
They don't go after humans?
No. There are stories about people being bitten by gar. And if you are bitten by a gar, you're probably harassing the animal. And that maybe it's snapping out of fear. But it's not going to go try to swallow a human.
Give us a sense. How big can an alligator gar get?
Well, we think that some of the maximum sizes for these fish are over 300 pounds. There is an anecdotal record of a fish that was 350 pounds from the Rio Grande, possibly up to 400 pounds. There was a fish caught recently in... if I'm correct, 2011 on Valentine's Day from Lake Chotard, which is near Vicksburg, Mississippi. And this fish was 8.5 feet long and was 327 pounds.
And as you've indicated, there are efforts underway to kind of get the alligator gar reintroduced in Illinois and Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
How is that going, and where else might we see these efforts as far as reintroduction?
I would say anywhere where the fish was historically found. And we're looking, you know, up midway to the high reaches of the Mississippi River, and then some of the tributaries in the Mississippi River over into the Ohio River, and then down the coast to Texas, and then even into northern Mexico. Alligator gar were historically found till about the northern reaches of Veracruz. And then from there, we see a smaller relative of the alligator gar, the tropical gar, that's found along the coast all the way down to Costa Rica. We have these records of where these fish were found, but unfortunately we don't have the habitat. That's the main reason why we have lost these alligator gar populations. Of course, there's also overfishing. These are long-lived fishes and generally are more susceptible to overfishing, like most other progressing long-lived type of fishes, even though these guys do have some tremendous growth rates. If we don't have the habitat, we can put the fish out there, but then they're not going to be able to reproduce themselves.
So that's like if we're talking about the Great Lakes. If we wanted to have these in the Great Lakes to help fight off Asian carp, they're not going to take hold.
Well, we don't know yet. I mean, these are very plastic animals. They're able to adapt. I don't know if they're going to be able to adapt to the cold conditions. Now, you have tributaries along the Great Lakes. There are areas where there's going to be flooded vegetation, and there's shallow bays and everything that could serve as spawning habitat. But, I don't want to put something into this area that is not native, because let's say they do their job well and they get rid of all of the Asian carp. Well, the Asian carp are gone, and if the gar are able to reproduce, then what are they going to eat?
Bottom line, Elise, you're talking to people who live in Michigan who are alarmed at the prospect of Asian carp getting into Lake Michigan and into our Great Lakes and Lake Erie, Lake Huron.
I grew up on Lake Erie, so I can definitely sympathize.
All right, so you hear us talking about the alligator gar. Is this something that could help protect our Great Lakes?
Oh, boy, I'm going out on a limb here. They could eat the carp. I'm very, very hesitant to say that introducing a species outside of its range is the right thing to do. We would need to grow alligator gar in these more northern habitats and see if they can survive. If they can't, then we would have to continually produce alligator gar each year to feed on the carp, and a little alligator gar can't eat a big carp. So it may end up being too expensive to produce these large fish to be able to consume the carp in the Great Lakes, but lower down in the system, in the Mississippi and some of the tributaries, we could try to control the numbers of the Asian carps, which may hopefully slow their spread.
It certainly seems like they might be more effective than that little electric barrier that we see near Chicago trying to keep them from getting into the Great Lakes.
I totally understand what they're trying to do. You don't want those fish there, but you also have to remember what's the impact that you're going to have on the system. Not just the Asian carp, but what are the other organisms you're going to be impacting? So, I would say in the lower portions of the region that alligator gar would be a very good method to try to control the carps, because nothing else can eat them.
And I love the way you say a good ancient species that's done it well and doesn't need to change.
Right.
Elise Ferrara is a professor of biological sciences. She's an alligator gar expert from Nicholls State University in Louisiana. It was great talking with you, Elise. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The best and the brightest.
Opportunities.
The next idea.
We're going to find that these social and cultural factors really add a lot to economic growth.
Just think a moment of all the music that has been born and bred in Detroit, from Motown to techno, rock to hip hop to jazz, and all parts in between. Detroit artists have reached the world. Yet the city has done next to nothing to capitalize on its musical heritage. Our latest contributor to The Next Idea is leading an effort to change all of that. He wants to get Detroit to brand itself as a music city, including building a downtown museum to celebrate Southeast Michigan's rich musical heritage. Howard Hertz is a leading entertainment attorney, and he is the founder of the Detroit Music Hall of Fame and Museum. It's a nonprofit effort, and it's great to have you with us on The Next Idea, Howard.
Pleasure to be here.
In fact, before we even start, we should probably say that name is kind of a working name, but you're still looking for something snappier.
Right. The name is, it describes the museum. Mm-hmm. But even for a museum, we want something more. And now that we've expanded the whole concept to a rebranding of Detroit and the region as a music city, we want to find a name that encompasses both the region, the rebranding, and the museum. So we've got a few names that are being kicked around, and we're talking to some branding experts to help us figure out, you know, what really works and what's going to resonate with people.
Well, let's loop around and get back into really the heart of this, the idea of rebranding Detroit as a music city. What does that actually mean?
Well, it's interesting. I kind of fell into the whole concept of the rebranding just a couple years ago. The museum idea has been kicking around and moving toward fruition for 10 or 12 years now, that I've been talking to people and waiting for the timing to be right, which is right now.
Get the economy out of the doldrums and
well,
back
yeah,
up again?
Not just the economy, just the excitement in Detroit, which I guess, you know, is somewhat related to the economy. But everything going on in Detroit, all of the rebirth of the city, really lends itself to celebrating Detroit's music. I travel annually to the south of France for the International Music Festival in Cannes. Everyone knows about the Cannes Film Festival. Well, there's a Cannes Music Festival, and I've gone for 19 years now. And the first year that I got there, I was a little hesitant because here's 7,500 people from around the world in the music industry, and I'm walking in. I'm from Detroit. And I was curious to see what the reaction would be, because that was at a time when Detroit was at, you know, one of its lowest points. And it wasn't a negative reaction at all. It was, oh, my God. And they were bowing, you know, homage to Detroit because of the musical history. And everyone wanted to talk. And they wanted to talk about techno, or they wanted to talk about Motown, or they wanted to talk about Fortune Records even before Motown. They all had a thought in their head that reminded them of Detroit music and wanted to talk about it. It was great.
So something went on in your mind, went, we have something here.
Right. Around the world, we're known as a music city, but we haven't really pushed that button and benefited from the tourism that it can bring and from the positive image that it can help give the city.
And certainly this idea of branding a city as a music city, it's been done elsewhere. Nashville comes to mind. New Orleans, certainly. Berlin. There's examples of that. And what can that identity mean, particularly to benefit the economy of those cities?
Well, a couple of years ago, there was a conference that was being held in France, and it was the mastering of a music city and how do you do it and what are the benefits. And certainly one of the benefits is the ability to bring people to Detroit for the music. Right now, I don't think that happens much other than Jazz Fest and the Techno Festival movement. Those are two large events that actually bring people. But when you've got the auto show, people are always saying, where's the music? What do I do?
Where do I go? That's right.
And we need to fill in the gaps and make sure that people know where to go. and that there are places for people to go.
And to the point of having a museum, certainly, you know, Hitsville and West Grand Boulevard, people love it. In fact, we have two visitors coming from London this September, and the first thing that we have to go do is we have to go to Hitsville. And we see that. I mean, Paul McCartney comes to Detroit. What does he do before he plays Comerica? Goes over to Hitsville. Beyonce's team. That has that
right.
recognition.
And it's fabulous.
It is. It's fabulous. But there's so much more to tell.
Much more. Actually, my idea for having a museum came from an article I read, and I'm guessing it was about 12 years ago, in the Free Press, I believe, that was saying that the Motown Museum was considering moving to the larger Motown building that used to be on Woodward and the freeway, and that they were putting a board together and blah, blah, blah. So I called the woman in the article who I knew and said, I'm interested, but only if you expand it beyond just Motown. Motown will certainly be a huge part of it. This is Motown. Yeah. But there is so much more than just Motown music. And they came back to me and said, sorry, we're not interested. And I said, well, I guess I'll have to do it on my own.
And so here we are. I'm talking with entertainment attorney Howard Hertz, who is trying to is leading an effort to brand Detroit as a music city, and that would include a downtown museum to celebrate the rich musical heritage. Exactly then, what are the goals that you're setting to get this going and get this moving, Howard?
Well, the goals are on the rebranding side, especially. We've got four of us on the executive committee right now that are planning what are the things that will help to make us a music city other than a physical presence of a museum. So one of the things, for example, that other cities do is when you arrive at the airport, wouldn't it be wonderful to have music playing in the lobby area, maybe next to where the fountain is in the Delta terminal?
At McNamara,
That is symbolic of Detroit music. They do that in Austin. They do that in Nashville, I believe, and Seattle, and we should do that here. So that's just one tiny sliver. But a lot of it is coordinating everything that's going on. Maybe we need an app because we do have many venues that have music performing. So maybe there needs to be a Detroit music app where on any day you can click on it and find out what acts are playing and where, what genre of music. So you do know where to go. So, yeah, something that makes it easy.
Have you had a chance to have conversations with city leaders?
Yes. Actually, one of our board members, our executive board members, works for the mayor. And we're part of the whole plan and the mastering of a music city advocates to have a person that is actually employed by the city as a liaison between the advisory board and the city, because there are a lot of issues that will pop up from parking to noise control. One of the things that our goal, at least, I don't know if we can pull it off, is to go to every restaurant and bar and music venue in the downtown and midtown area, for starters, and say, do you have music, live music? If so, how many nights a week? And if not, why not? And our goal is to get every venue to try to have music every night or five nights out of the week, let's say. And their biggest complaint is going to be, well, it's costing too much money and we don't know what the benefit is going to be from this effort. So we're going to say to them, well, how much would you pay per night? And just to pick a number out of the air, let's say they say, well, I'd pay $200 a night to try it. And then we go to the bands and say, what do you charge in order to play a gig at a restaurant or at a bar for a night? And let's say they, well, we try and get $500 a night, let's say. And then close that gap. And then in that gap, there'll still be a difference. Maybe we can get the bar into paying $250 and we can get the artist down to $350 and then actually subsidize that $100 per night for a 6 month or a 1 year period, you know, get a foundation to help support this effort and make it so that all of a sudden anywhere you go downtown or midtown, there is music playing and that's going to bring people.
Well, I'll tell you, when we went down to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for a visit last year, and as I was driving home and I thought, the Detroit area could totally pull off something like that. So
absolutely,
it's exciting. Well, you'll keep us posted, and as the name evolves, I mean, you say you've got the nonprofit in place. It's the Detroit Music Hall of Fame and Museum for now, but I'm sure there's going to be a great name forthcoming. And please keep us surprised.
I will.
Howard Hertz, always great to have you with us. Thank you for being with us on the Next Idea.
Support for the Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Still to come, two pediatricians say it is time to stop letting parents opt out of vaccinations. We'll hear more in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals today heard a challenge to Michigan's emergency manager law. John Filo is executive director and legal director of the not-for-profit Sugar Law Center in Detroit. He's with us now from Cincinnati, where the appeals court heard the oral arguments. John, exactly what happened today?
Well, there was a hearing today on our challenge to Michigan's emergency manager law. Both us and the state gave arguments. We've been arguing as consistently all along that the emergency manager law violates people's fundamental right to vote in a number of ways.
Exactly what are you asking of the court today, of the appeals court?
Is to recognize that there is a valid claim, at least that we've stated a valid claim, for violation of voting rights under the Equal Protection Clause, under the Voting Rights Act, under notions of substantive due process. If they agree, it would be sent back to the trial court for the trial.
You want the Court of Appeals to reverse a Detroit federal judge's order that tossed most of a lawsuit that challenged this law, correct?
Right. The judge at the lower court, we never got into the factual discovery phase. What the judge did in the lower court in Detroit is said there is no claim that exists that we could plead to get the remedy we were seeking. Essentially, the court said there was no impairment of the right to vote by the adoption of the emergency manager law or putting emergency managers in place. With respect to equal protection and the Voting Rights Act, we think it's very hard to get around the fact that when an emergency manager comes into office, the local elected officials have no more governing power. That is all transferred to emergency manager. Well, if the people you elect no longer have the powers of the office, then your right to vote has been taken back. Additionally, we say, look, if there's a legislative official, and this is under ideas of substantive due process, if there's a legislative official, which is somebody who can pass laws, govern the people, that person must be elected. But the problem that we face in this case is that there is no state that's done what Michigan has done. There's no state that's transferred governing power, all governing power from elected officials with legislative powers to one person. There's no state who sought to resolve their financial emergency by taking the voters out of the aspect. So there's no prior case law.
All right. This is all new for the court.
Right.
So what did the state say back?
One is a theme of the states can do whatever they want with local governments, that local governments simply are not bound by the Constitution in the same way that a state official themselves would be. And they are urging the court to give broad discussion to the state to experiment with their local governments. The sort of other theme, which was a bit curious, was saying that the elected officials still retain significant authority in emergency manager communities. That runs contrary to the experience in communities that have had emergency managers, and it's contrary to the text of the law.
John, what kind of questions did you get from the appeals court judges?
There were some factual questions about what the law does along the lines of have elected officials, in fact, been displaced? And there's numerous instances where in certain communities, elected officials were literally locked out of the building. But there were other areas. Some were saying, how is this different than an administrative regulation? And then there were other ones along the lines of, well, is there in fact a right to vote for local officials in any sense? Given the novelty of what the emergency manager law does, what you're doing is drawing analogy to other cases that are very factually different, and both sides were doing that.
And now that oral arguments have been made, John, what comes next?
There will be a decision from this court. We will seek further appeal if we don't prevail. If we do prevail, we'll be back in the trial court.
And just help break it down for us. If you don't have a decision that goes in your way and you say we'll pursue it, what would be the next step up?
It depends on how the ruling is made, but we could ask for a hearing before the entire Sixth Circuit. And then if we lost, we could conceivably ask for a hearing before all the judges of the Sixth Circuit. And then there's the Supreme Court. We will pursue it to the last appeal that we can.
What do you believe is at stake here, John?
I thought it was very interesting listening to radio on the way down here. I think it was author Jeffrey Toobin who was asked, what is the most important issue that you see in the next, 2 to 10 years in the United States? And he, without hesitation, said voting rights. There has been a sustained erosion of those rights. We believe that this is part of that, and we believe that this case can fundamentally alter your voting rights, particularly the assumed right we've always had is that we can elect local officials and those officials who make our laws. We really believe that that is fundamentally what is at stake here.
John Filo is the executive director and the legal director of the Sugar Law Center in Detroit. John, thank you for filling us in on today's oral arguments, and I am sure we will be talking as this case proceeds.
Well, thank you for having me.
Vaccination. Many physicians and public health scientists view it as the greatest development in modern medicine. And that certainly is the viewpoint of University of Michigan pediatric residents, Drs. Phoebe Day Danziger and Rebecca Diamond. They found themselves trying to work with and reason with parents who refused to have their children vaccinated. And the doctors wondered, why do we allow anti-vaccine parents to expose their kids and the rest of society to diseases which should have been wiped out? And they wonder, is it time to make vaccination mandatory? These are among the questions the doctors pose in a piece they co-authored for Slate last week called The Vaccination Double Standard. Drs. Phoebe Day Danziger and Rebecca Diamond are here with us. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Before we get into your thoughts about the vaccination double standard, I want to talk about vaccinations. Is there any solid, peer-reviewed medical evidence, anything that has not been debunked or discredited, that would indicate that there could be any danger or any risk in getting vaccinated, Phoebe?
You know, as we discussed in our article, a lot of the claims and concerns that have been raised have been really thoroughly investigated. And, you know, as we say in the piece, they've really been asked and answered. As a field, we've looked at a lot of these concerns and, studied millions and millions of children over many decades and really found that, these fears are simply unfounded.
Rebecca, what are the known risks to babies and children that would be associated with the main vaccinations, for instance, mm-hmm. that schools want to see?
Yeah. So nothing is risk-free. Everything has risks and benefits, but the benefits of vaccination far outweigh the risks of vaccination. So we always like to just preface everything with that in case anyone thinks we're asking for 100% perfect treatment in any sort of medical field. The major risks are a little bit of fever a few days after the vaccine, some pain at the injection site, maybe a 1 in 100 million risk of serious allergic reaction that would be treated at the physician's office. And that's pretty much it as far as the literature shows.
And you both believe, because you said it in your piece for Slate, that vaccinations are arguably the very greatest invention of modern medicine.
Yeah, we absolutely do. We were saying, aside from the introduction of safe, clean water supply, mm-hmm. we can't really think of anything else yeah. that's had this profound of an impact on child health and population health.
What is this vaccination double standard, Rebecca?
Vaccinations are universally thought to be one of the most amazing inventions in modern medicine. And there is a group of people who, for whatever series of reasons, partially because of certain interest groups that have exploited very caring parents, that have decided vaccinations are unsafe. And we have, as a society, have allowed this group of people to not vaccinate their children. To really understand this argument, you need to take a step back and ask yourself the question, do children have rights in our society? Are there protections that we have enacted for our children? And the answer is yes. We have set limits to care and how it can be provided from parents, and we have set certain rules of how parents should care for their children, and it should include things like clean drinking water, vaccination, proper medication, access to health care, seatbelts, all of these things, education, and it does include all of those things except for vaccinations.
as pediatricians, we always strive for joint decision making with families. But like Rebecca was saying, there are plenty of other preventive measures like car seats that mm-hmm. we say are, you know, just important enough that parents can't simply choose to opt out of those. You know, adults, we say, have the right to decline the medical standard of care for themselves. But when it comes to their children who can't advocate for themselves, we've decided as a society that they simply don't have the right to opt out for their children when it means exposing them and leaving them potentially vulnerable to harm.
Now, in your piece for Slate, you say, and these were your words, we kowtow to parents who oppose vaccination. And I'm going to quote here, these parents almost always come from privilege and they are almost never punished for their actions. You believe this is at least partially informed. And again, I'll quote you here, by the fact that they are by and large white, educated, and affluent. How do you know this?
There's been personal experience that we've seen, but there's also been some studies that we cited in the article that look at the demographics of the anti-vaccine movement.
Because there was one physician who commented on your piece in Slate, and he or she supports vaccination, believes that anti-vaccination weakens herd immunity, but made the comment that thought your comments about race were baseless and that felt it was inappropriate to introduce race without supportive evidence. But you're saying the evidence is there.
Yeah, the evidence is there. There have been a number of studies, as Rebecca said, looking at just the demographics of who are the vaccine refusers, who are the vaccine skeptics. And by and large, they are white, affluent, privileged.
And you talk in your piece about the double standard you see as far as something that you feel is systemic racism and classism here.
You know, and I would say just that even in our brief experience as physicians, we've seen plenty of action taken against families who are exposing their children to far less risk than parents who are choosing not to vaccinate their children and making them vulnerable to serious illness. And yet we don't do anything about it.
You actually opened the piece by talking about a case where you found out that Child Protective Services had stepped in the case of a single mother. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little more about that.
Well, this is a common thing that we've seen, and I worry that we get a little too far off the point here of protecting the unvaccinated children, but the discrepancy in how we care for and protect children is systemic. I think there's no question about that. I've seen it in my personal experience. My physician peers have seen it. It's been written about extensively about how there are worse healthcare outcomes for the poor, for the minorities. This is a fact, and for the anti-vaccine movement to focus on personal liberties and fair healthcare is a little bit misguided because that is actually happening in our society, but that's not what the anti-vaccine movement is focused on.
I'm speaking with University of Michigan pediatric residents, Drs. Phoebe Day Danziger and Rebecca Diamond, who wrote a piece in Slate titled The Vaccination Double Standard. Where do you feel that the anti-vaccination movement began and also got so deeply rooted in the sense that people are so passionate about that?
It has been sort of a multifactorial rise over the past few decades. I think that it draws on different threads that we're seeing sort of emerge more strongly in our society and culture today, drawing on what I think is some valid skepticism of the historical practices in medicine that were deeply paternalistic and not patient-centered at all. And then, you know, skepticism towards some of the larger regulatory agencies and the pharmaceutical industry. And, you know, again, I think a lot of this is founded in sort of valid criticism and good intentions, but that it has taken off and become distorted.
And you commented on something I wanted to ask you about, and you wrote about in your piece, the concept of patient-centered care. You say it's good in theory, but risky in practice. Exactly what is that concept of patient-centered care, Rebecca?
I can't emphasize enough that working with patients, working with families, that is our favorite part of our job. And the ideal of patient-centered care is, you know, is not a dangerous thing. It's a wonderful thing. What happens is when we in our society don't truly understand what the partnership between patients and physicians and families and physicians is going to be, and instead create this almost adversarial position of patient desires versus physician recommendations, that's what becomes dangerous. It's not the working together for patient goals, but the idea that, well, I have this fear. I read this in an article. I'm right. You're wrong as a physician. And it really just becomes a divide. That is what's dangerous.
You say in your piece that you really do believe that we society, and therefore I guess you mean the government, should take the vaccination decision out of parents' hands and make it mandatory. Are you saying this is the same way that we don't let people decide whether or not to have a child in a safety seat?
we knew that the call to mandate vaccines would be controversial, but the fact is that California has already moved forward with mandating vaccines, and even Michigan has, you know, recently implemented stronger barriers to personal belief exemptions. And what worries me is that these types of strong policies are really the exception when you look at it on a national level. The medical and public health communities have become too complacent in accepting vaccine refusal for children as a matter of personal belief. You know, and I think we're not upholding the obligation to advocate for the best interest of children.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there are some really important topics here, patient-centered care and the idea of personal liberties versus our societal obligation, the idea of herd immunity, protecting other people's children. These are all wonderful, important things to talk about. But in the meantime, the children of unvaccinating parents, they're the ones who are suffering. We are here advocating for those unvaccinated children. That is the novel approach that we are taking here, is that we're not talking about other people's children. We are talking about these children. This is not radical. It's novel, but it's not radical because as a society, we have decided that children have human rights and they have the right to health, happiness, basic medical care. We've already created a medical framework. We're not asking for a new implementation of that. We're asking for more honesty about that framework. We're hoping that the existing medical framework will encompass the greatest medical invention, which is vaccination, in addition to other minor medical interventions that it already does encompass.
Phoebe, you're a mom, so you have these two viewpoints. Do you ever find yourself as a mom at odds with yourself as a pediatrician when it comes to health choices for your kids?
Sure. You know, as the mother of three girls, I would say there are certainly a lot of scary things in the world today, from gun violence to environmental pollution to unregulated chemicals in various products. And, you know, I just think vaccines are just not one of the scary things to me. It's really distressing, the idea that we are potentially returning to a time when infants and children were routinely, you know, seriously harmed and even died from these vaccine-preventable illnesses. You know, I think for me as a mother, I feel so grateful that we have such safe and effective ways of preventing these things. And so my worries as a mother really lie elsewhere.
Rebecca, what's been the reaction to your piece in Slate?
There's been a lot of positive reaction, and I'm very pleased with that. I think the community, especially the medical community, has been, you know, very accepting. Sometimes it seems like the focus is still more on the herd immunity aspect and the public health. And I'm so grateful for that and for the people who are proponents of public health. But again, trying to steer this argument towards the protection of the unvaccinated children, I think gives us more ground, works within an established framework that we've created as society. Of course, there's been a negative reaction from those who really strongly oppose vaccination, and that was to be expected.
And we are going to hear from those people, the ones who are vehemently opposed to having their children vaccinated, and they will cite studies and anecdotes. What do you make? I'll ask you this, Phoebe, first. What do you make of that extremely strong reaction from people who are anti-vaccination?
Most of the parents that we've worked with who are hesitant about vaccines or refuse vaccines are really coming from a good, well-meaning place. They want to do what's best for their children. And there are all these fears and misconceptions out there about dangerous side effects of vaccines and, you know, about vaccines being hugely profitable for doctors and the pharmaceutical companies. And, you know, all of these claims have been debunked, but, you know, that doesn't seem to translate to any reassurance for these parents who, you know, I think for the most part are trying to do what's best for their children.
And so is the pediatrician, which leads to that odd feeling, Rebecca,
right,
of feeling like you're on opposite sides of the team instead of together on the same team.
Which is really a sad experience, you know, for the family and for the physician. I mean, we went into pediatrics not to tell families what to do, but to help families and really help these children thrive. And to have a parent who's so well-meaning and loves their child so much, and then all we want to do is use our medical knowledge to help that child, it feels terrible. And it feels like I would love to have people really understand that there clearly is another interest group, or there's some other group out there that's making that happen, because it's not a natural relationship, this dichotomy between physician and parent. And it really does get in the way of patient care.
Dr. Phoebe Day-Danziger and Dr. Rebecca Diamond are pediatric residents at the University of Michigan. Their co-authored piece at Slate.com is titled The Vaccination Double Standard. It was great to have you in with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Tony Brown. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.